From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On June 28th, a big Chinook helicopter carrying U.S. military personnel was shot down in Afghanistan. All 16 special forces on board were killed. Eight were Navy SEALs, the Navy's elite force that takes its name from high-level operations on sea, land, and air. The helicopter was dispatched to rescue four other SEAL commandos trapped by Taliban fighters in rugged mountains. Only one of those four survived. The dramatic story of the failed Operation Red Wing is being described as the worst debacle in the history of the Navy SEALs. It has also provided a rare, bloody glimpse into resurgent fighting in Afghanistan. 4 years after the invasion in 2001, Afghanistan is heating up again, now with reported spillover from the Iraq War. Tonight on Point, the story of Operation Red Wing and what U.S. Special Forces are looking for and finding in the mountains of Afghanistan. We go first tonight to the region. I spoke earlier with Tim McGurk, correspondent for Time Magazine, who was in Afghanistan last week and joined me today from Islamabad, Pakistan. Also with us on the line from Kabul, Halima Karzim, an Afghan-American correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Halima Karzim, what's the latest on the four escapees from the Bagram base in Afghanistan?
Well, there is some unconfirmed reports, basically, that one of the escapees has been caught in a mosque in the Bagram area, which Bagram is a large area right outside of Kabul city, but that hasn't been confirmed by the U.S. military, but there are reports that one of them has been located. The other three have yet to be found.
I want to turn and look at the very dramatic events of the last couple of weeks, but we want to understand this breaking news a little bit better. How is it possible that these four men, the U.S. military is describing them as real threats in the global war on terrorism, a threat not only to Afghans but globally, one from Syria, one from Saudi Arabia, one from Kuwait, one from Libya. How could they escape from the center of the main U.S. base in Afghanistan? What's known?
This came as a big surprise because the base is very heavily fortified. It is the main base for U.S. military in Afghanistan, where planes fly in and out of neighboring countries, and also Kandahar base, the U.S. military base. Now, it came as a very big surprise, and it's also seen as an embarrassment for the U.S. military because it is a heavily fortified base and with a lot of protection. And for four people to be able to escape, especially because the prison that they were, the compound, is reportedly in a back area of a base, so they would have had to gone through several checkpoints, and it is believed that they escaped in a vehicle. Now, the details are, of course, not clear and very sketchy at this point, but it does come as a surprise because it is the most important military base for the U.S. here.
It would suggest, Halima, that they had help from the inside in escaping from Bagram, the big U.S. base.
Yes, it does. It does suggest, especially with the military reporting that there weren't any U.S. Forces injured in the prison break, implying that there wasn't any kind of fighting between forces and the prisoners, that they escaped without anyone finding out till later.
Tim McGurk in Islamabad with Time Magazine. These events of the last day and a half there come after a couple of very dramatic weeks. We're going to dig into the story with you of the Special Operations Forces, the Navy SEALs, who went through such high drama in the last couple of weeks in eastern, northeastern Afghanistan. But give us a little backdrop here, background. What is happening in Afghanistan, particularly with the fighting that you'll describe for us, that has raised it to this new pitch?
I mean, it's interesting. It seems a few months back, Afghan and U.S. military sources were both saying that, look, the Taliban are, they're a waning force. They can really never muster enough firepower and enough men to really do any damage. And then, we've seen that the Taliban have been capable of putting together a string of very deadly attacks, assassinating clergymen, police officials who've been backing President Karzai. And then this, where they've not only managed to ambush a team of Navy reconnaissance commandos, but also to shoot down the Chinook helicopter that was filled with 16 commandos and crewmen.
Tim, I wish you'd take us back to the beginning of this deadly and dramatic sequence of events that began on June 28th. The Navy SEAL crew that was sent in on what was called Operation Red Wing. Can you describe this squad of four men that was sent in? Where were they sent and why were they sent? What was the mission?
Well, it's not really clear what the mission was, but what we do know is that this part of northeastern Afghanistan, the mountains are very, very high. They're carpeted with forest. It's close to the Pakistan border, and all of these reasons make it the perfect spot for the Taliban to roam across the frontier. And this reconnaissance team of four men were sent out there probably to try and stop the Taliban from crossing over from Pakistan. And instead, it turns out that they were surrounded, ambushed by a much larger force of Taliban. And there they were getting hit by rockets and mortars and a constant spray of small arms fire. So they sent a message of help back to the base, and immediately a Chinook helicopter was scrambled. And while the helicopter was winging its way up to this northeastern corner of Afghanistan, the four Navy SEALs managed to break out of the first ambush of the Taliban, and they kept up a running firefight for about 3 miles almost up and down the mountains with the Taliban outgunning them and outmanning them and chasing them along the way. We know that at some point when the Chinook appeared in the valley, then there was another force of Taliban that went after the helicopter, and because it was flying so low in these narrow valleys, it was an easy target for a rocket-propelled grenade. And that felled the helicopter, killed all 16 men aboard. And in the meantime, the firefight up in the mountains continued. And two of the U.S. Navy SEALs were killed. A fourth, as it turns out, even though his body was missing for days and days afterwards, was killed not too far from the very same spot. But one Navy SEAL did manage to survive the second ambush, and he made his way further up the mountain.
Tim, I wish you could hold the story there for just a minute, because it's very dramatic what you report this week in Time. Before we turn to that, Halima, tighten our focus on the area that we're talking about here and its significance. This is Kunar Province. This is northwest of Kabul, between Kabul and the Pakistan border, just north of the Khyber Pass, just across the area of Pakistan, where I believe it has long been rumored Osama bin Laden may be hiding. Do I have that right?
That's correct. This has been in a very volatile province with not very much development because of that. So that's kind of a vicious cycle: no development, high volatility, and vice versa. This is an incredibly mountainous area, basically with deep ravines, steep mountains, and a lot of hideouts, places where insurgents can hide out. It has an open border, about 217-mile border with Pakistan, and neighboring provinces are just as volatile. So it is an area of Afghanistan where military operations have been high and insurgency has been high as well.
And when you say military operations have been high, Halima, do you mean that U.S. forces are frequently in this area, or was it rare to have a team of U.S. commandos, Navy SEALs, in there?
Well, because of this Kunar situation, it has brought to the forefront the shadowy war on terror that has been going on in Afghanistan, that we have not been, as Afghans and as journalists, as informed about, of course, U.S. military operations in the south. But this really brings to the forefront that there are operations still going on, especially in these regions like Kunar.
And Tim, in Islamabad, we want to get the story of how the final Navy SEAL was rescued, but tell us first, what do you know? What have you learned from your reporting about how much activity is underway on the part of U.S. troops and U.S. special forces in particular?
Well, I mean, as Halima was saying, it's very shadowy what they're doing up there. There is a U.S. base in Assadabad in Kunar. The man who runs it is Special Forces. The Marines were up there, and they're always sending these reconnaissance parties up into the mountains. So there's definitely a lot going on, but I don't think there's any proof that anyone has that Osama bin Laden might be up there instead of some other place along the long border with Pakistan.
Fair enough. Is this currently the hottest region in military action in Afghanistan?
The hottest area is Zabul province, with probably next in Helmand province. Zabul is next to Kandahar. It is, I would consider, and many security officials will say, the most dangerous province in this country. But Kunar does top, you know, is on the top of the list for volatile areas and probably high military operations.
So you're saying further south, near Kandahar, would be even hotter. Tim, what's your sense?
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think what we're seeing is kind of there's suddenly eruptions of attacks that are happening all along the Pakistan-Afghan border from the north in Kunar way down to the south to Kandahar. There are a lot more people coming across. They're in bigger groups, and they're better armed.
And we've also had reports that they're armed or at least have expertise coming out of explosives in Iraq. Have you heard the same?
Yeah, I have. That some of the U.S. military down in Kandahar, for example, found IEDs. And they said that, look, the technology that's come into this is something that they've learned from terrorists in Iraq. And it doesn't take long for things to cross-fertilize between the insurgents in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
Tim McGurk in Islamabad and Halima Karzoum in Kabul, please stand by. We're talking tonight about U.S. operations, special operations in Afghanistan, about the rising level of conflict there and the high drama of the last couple of weeks. When we come back, we'll have the details of how that last Navy SEAL was rescued, a surprising story in the mountains of Afghanistan. Thanks to you both for being with us. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the rising level of violence, of combat in Afghanistan, about U.S. operations, military operations there, and in particular about the dramatic and, in most respects, disastrous operation that unfolded in the last couple of weeks that led a party of four losing three Navy SEALs in the mountains of Afghanistan and 16 Navy SEALs and other special forces killed in the downing of a Chinook helicopter along the Pakistani border just east-northeast of Kabul. I'm joined tonight by Tim McGurk. He joins us from Islamabad in Pakistan. He's a correspondent there for Time magazine. His exclusive story, How the Shepherd Saved the SEAL, and we'll hear it in a moment, appears in this week's issue of Time. And from Kabul in Afghanistan, Halima Karzoum, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Tim, when you left off the story of the last Navy SEAL who was crawling along that high ridge there in Kunar province, having eluded somehow the many Taliban fighters who were there, who had brought down the Chinook, he sounded in desperate straits. Tell us what happened.
Well, he was on the run by himself, crawling and scrambling along for several days. And then a shepherd came across him, found him bloodied, but still holding firmly onto his gun. The shepherd at that point remembered that for Americans, a thumbs up is a friendly gesture. So he made that to the soldier, and then also lifted up his tunic, his shalwar kameez, and showing that he had no weapons. So then he helped the American. They hobbled along to the village, and in the village they held a meeting, and they said, well, what do we do with this American soldier? We know the Taliban are after him. And do we throw him to the wolves, or do we look after him? And the village gathered, and they decided that they would, according to the honor of Pashtuns, they would give him their protection. And they did just that. They protected him.
This is Pashtun tradition. Once you've given hospitality to someone, you must protect them, even if in other circumstances they might not be a friend. How did they get word to American forces that he was there? How was this Navy SEAL ultimately taken back in to the U.S. military central?
Well, the villagers were a bit worried because they received a message from the Taliban saying, hand this guy over, he's ours. And the villagers turned around and replied that, no, we're not going to give him over, we're going to fight, you know, to the last man in the village. But they decided that they'd better hide him, and so they stuck him in a barn or a stable. And the next day, one of the men, the shepherd, went down to the American base in Asadabad, which was about a six-hour trek.
This is the town, more or less, in the middle of Kunar province.
That's right. And then, so he went to the base, told the Americans, "Hey, I've got one of your men; he's alive." And then, from what we heard, then the soldiers all went up and brought him back down the mountain.
Did they fly up, or did they go on foot? Is it safe for Americans to fly in this region now?
I honestly don't know, Tom, whether they flew or they went on foot. Maybe Halima knows, but I would guess that they probably went on foot because it was hard to get to the place. It was in the forest, and they were probably still very worried about what had happened to the Chinook.
And you describe how this shepherd who found the Navy SEAL high in these extremely rugged mountains in Afghanistan now fears for his own life and that of his family. What measures has he taken?
They say that he got quite a bit of money from the Americans, but he's decided that he's going to flee with his family because he's afraid that the Taliban will come back to the village and find out that he was the man who was responsible for rescuing him and then take their revenge.
Halima, you've been there in Kabul as this story unfolded. Of course, there was the report that the last Navy SEAL, the undiscovered one, had been beheaded. The Taliban spokesman claimed that his head had been cut off. That turns out, we're told, as of Sunday, not to be true. How has this dramatic sequence of events rippled through the American military community there?
Well, in some ways, it's been, again, an embarrassment because the Navy SEALs are revered to be some of the best, you know, armed forces that the U.S. military has. And then on the other side, it's shown the extreme power of the insurgents and their reorganization. It's not just Taliban, it's Al-Qaeda, along with other political groups, armed groups, coming together, reorganizing. It's showing the increasing violence as we're heading towards the September 18th parliamentary elections. So basically, it's a big sign. It's a big sign to Afghans about increased violence and also to the U.S. military that the war on terror is still out there and going on. To get back to the shepherd that Tim was saying, it's an interesting point that this shows that Afghans, if innocent civilians are not killed in the process, Afghans are very supportive of the war on terror, as you can see from this shepherd helping a Navy SEAL. But when Afghan civilians are killed, especially in large numbers, then you have anti-American sentiment growing in this country. But you can see the honesty of the Afghans trying to rid their country of foreign agents and insurgents and rebel groups.
And unfortunately, we've had just such large numbers of civilian deaths in recent weeks. Halima Karzum, you are Afghan yourself, as I understand. What is your sense of what's going on with this country? Is it making forward progress? Are these fights in the shadows away from the main direction of the country, or is Afghanistan being once again pulled into a fire of conflict and combat?
Yes, I am Afghan-American, born in Afghanistan, raised in the United States,
mm-hmm.
And I do get a sense of both. I get a sense that Afghans are growing very concerned as every day goes by of the insurgency and the violence in the south. Now, the north of the country and mostly the west of the country are fairly calm, in even central parts, they're fairly calm. But every day, Afghans in Kabul and then the rest of the country are talking about the violence in the south. They are growing concerned. The international community is very concerned that the insurgency will spread to Kabul, which is very heavily fortified, and to the north. But so far, it has remained at the south. And it's never far from our minds, the violence and how easily it could spread to Kabul. Kabul is not very far from Kunar. Kabul is not very far from Paktika, which there's been violence as well. So it is constantly on our minds, and it has changed lifestyles, internationals, and locals here in Kabul.
And Tim McGurk, your thoughts, and from what you hear from your colleagues, you write that in Afghanistan today, when there are attacks, it's difficult to distinguish whether it's from the Taliban or criminal gangs or drug traffickers or Al-Qaeda. What's your sense of the general direction of the country with this bloody story as backdrop?
Well, I think that unfortunately what's happened is that there's a kind of a perilous drift that's set in, and that because of the chaos and the lawlessness, that you do have people with different agendas. You've got the Taliban who are trying to regain some of their power or at least sabotage the elections. You've got criminal gangs who are very, very upset about the fact that their opium harvests are being destroyed. And then at the same time, you have Al-Qaeda remnants who are still still in touch with the Taliban and still in touch with their sources of money coming in from the Gulf. So it all makes for a very volatile mix.
And as of today, many caskets of American soldiers out of merely the last 2 weeks. Tim McGuirk in Islamabad, Pakistan, thank you very much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Halima Karzam in Kabul, we'll have to talk again. Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Great, thank you.
Halima Karzam is correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Tim McGuirk is a correspondent for Time Magazine and spoke with me from Islamabad, Pakistan. His story, How the Shepherd Saved the Seal, appears in this week's issue of Time. We are talking tonight about the sad drama of Operation Red Wing and resurgent fighting in Afghanistan. You can join the conversation. Have you followed the fighting and dying of the last 2 weeks in the Afghan mountains? What does it mean for Kabul and for Washington when the U.S. military's most elite troops are picked off and shot down wholesale by resurgent Taliban and al-Qaeda forces in Afghanistan? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Arlington, Virginia, is Anthony Cordesman. He is Senior Fellow and Chair of Strategy at the Center for International and Strategic Studies. He's author of The Lessons of Afghanistan and a close observer and analyst of the conflicts in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Anthony Cordesman, good to have you with us tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening.
Also joining us from Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, is Larry Goodson. He's Director of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He's also a former advisor in Iraq to General John Abizaid, commander of U.S. troops in Iraq since July 2003. Larry Goodson, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Anthony Cordesman, first to you, if I may. What context do you put this failed Navy SEAL operation into? What do you read into it?
I think we need to be very careful, because it sounds, when you look at the casualties, as if this was a major engagement. In fact, you had people rushing in to rescue a four-man team. You had one helicopter, which was shot down. I won't describe it as a freak case, but it certainly was very rare. And while the SEALs are a very small, tightly knit group, the fact that 16 special forces were killed in one operation didn't reflect a resurgence or a sudden strengthening of the Taliban. It reflected, in many cases, or in many ways, an accident of war. But we also need to understand that this isn't just a problem in Afghanistan. We never really secured the western border of Pakistan, or for that matter, the areas in Afghanistan that were largely Pashtun. There were many areas which we could occupy temporarily, but where there was never any real presence by other U.S. forces or the Afghan government. And because of that, there's a fairly broad area in Pakistan and in Afghanistan that the Taliban and al-Qaeda can operate in. You also have problems in Central Asia, where former communist governments are still in power in some cases. And you have an Islamic resurgence there, and the Taliban can operate in those areas with some training in sanctuary. So when you look at this, rather than seeing this as an Afghan problem, you need to see it as a Pakistani problem, a Central Asian problem, and an Afghan problem.
Larry Goodson, wide open borders in many areas here, to be sure. Anthony Cordesman is right to say, and as we're saying tonight, Operation Red Wing, one operation gone badly wrong. At the same time, we're reading in the last couple of days about 10 Afghan soldiers beheaded in another area of the country, southern Helmand province, another 12 Afghan soldiers killed on Sunday in Paktika province. This hardly sounds like sweetness and light going on there. And you hear the concern we've heard from the reporter out of Kabul of Iraq-style IEDs and the potential for guerrilla activity moving into the city there. That tension, that concern, there's a tide pushing at the more settled areas.
I do think there has been a certain amount of learning back from Iraq going on among the remnants of al-Qaeda and the Taliban that do straddle and go back and forth across the multiple borders. there's no surprise that the violence has centered in Helmand and Zabul and Paktika and Paktia in Kunar, especially where the SEAL team was hit,
mm-hmm.
and then the rescue team was shot down, because that area north of Assadabad is very, very rugged, very remote, and also lies along the border with Pakistan, where it's also very rugged and remote for Pakistan as well. So what you mostly get there are the former Taliban, especially Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's forces in that area, and they go back and forth. And so I do think that there is some danger that the situation is going to worsen in Afghanistan, even though it is a region-wide situation, as Tony correctly notes.
You advised General Abizaid in Iraq. Of course, CENTCOM's responsibility goes wider than Iraq. These are very rare numbers for special forces, and as Anthony Cordesman says, of course, you could look at the downing of the Chinook with 16 special forces on board as a freak. Nevertheless, it was hit. We've heard of memorial services in Pearl Harbor, where a lot of these forces originated in the last 24 hours. A lot of pretty upset people there. What do you read into the specific incident here? Bad luck, bad planning, heroism in the effort to go in and get these SEALs out?
Well, probably a bit of bad luck and heroism, to be sure. But the bigger issue that I've raised with General Barno and General Eikenberry, that they're the commanders on the ground in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and they also have some control over Pakistan and Central Asia as well, as Tony Cordesman mentioned, is the concern that I have had all along about the role of the special operations elements and their ongoing effort to get the bad guys versus the broader effort of the United States in Afghanistan and in the region.
And what's your concern there?
Well, my concern is that the broader effort is the main effort. The broader effort is the effort to stabilize the country, to do nation building successfully there, to help a government come into being, to help that government stand up and function, and that going after the bad guys frequently results in either incidents like this one, or more commonly incidents where Afghan civilians or innocent Afghans are caught in the crossfire. Or are incorrectly targeted, and it seems to me that in the early phase of what we were doing in Afghanistan and likewise in Iraq, it was all about getting the bad guys. Now we've come to realize that it's less about that, and it's more about the nation building and so forth. But these kinds of operations continue to go on. Indeed, the argument can be made successfully that they need to continue going on, that this is an important part of rebuilding the country and so forth as well. So, but there's a risk attached to these operations, and from time to time, you got to pay the piper.
Tony Cordesman, your sense of the balance between special operations like we saw in this case and what Larry Goodson describes as the broader effort to stabilize these countries, this country?
Well, as Larry points out, you have a legacy here. We went in. We did not occupy the country. We didn't create stability. We basically operated out of Kabul. That left much of Afghanistan under the control of warlords. Now, gradually there has been some expansion of the central government influence. But that can be easily exaggerated. Often what it consists of is not nation building, but bribing or co-opting a given warlord. The government doesn't come in with a solid presence. There isn't the kind of economic aid to really stabilize the region. The counter-narcotics campaign basically, if it succeeds, deprives people of their main source of income without having a way to replace it. And we talk about Afghans, but there are still massive divisions and tensions between the Pashtuns, the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, the various Shiite groups and so on. This is not a united country. It hasn't been the united country. So it's absolutely correct to say that the nation-building aspects of this remain weak.
Anthony Cordesman, Larry Goodson, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about U.S. Navy SEALs fighting and dying in Afghanistan. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine the desperate struggle of those American men on the high ridges above the Khyber Pass? What does it mean if Iraqi-style insurgent tactics are now being exported to Afghanistan? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about U.S. Navy SEALs fighting and dying in Afghanistan and the situation in Afghanistan and the surrounding countries there. Today, you can join the conversation tonight. Did you follow the drama of Navy SEALs fighting in the Afghan mountains in the last couple of weeks? And what is the trend line of conflict in Afghanistan? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're hearing about the complexities of this situation tonight, but we've got a lot of dead American soldiers in this one incident, and it turns a person's head, not to mention the jailbreak we heard from the Bagram Air Force Base, the main U.S. base in Afghanistan, just in the last 24 hours, of what we're told are important al-Qaeda prisoners who somehow got out of deep within that prison without a shot, we're told, being fired. We're joined tonight from Arlington, Virginia, by Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow and Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, from Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, by Larry Goodson, Director of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College and author of Afghanistan's Endless War, State Failure, Regional Politics, and the Rise of the Taliban, and right now from Arlington, Virginia, by Major James Gavrilis. He's a Major, U.S. Army Special Forces, an expert in special operations, unconventional warfare, counterinsurgency, recently returned from his last tour in Iraq, where he was responsible for the planning and execution of joint counter-terrorist and counterinsurgency operations. He was directing the operations of all U.S. Army Special Forces teams operating throughout that country. Major Gavrilis, thank you for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
I wish you'd put Operation Red Wing in a context for us. We read that this is one of the sort of worst incidents in the history of the Navy SEALs. Just how bad was it? Describe for us how you see it. What's the ripple coming out of this to U.S. Special Forces?
Well, certainly it's an unfortunate incident when anyone is killed in action, and certainly it was made worse when the helicopter crashed, because that's most of the casualties were from that helicopter crash.
Mm-hmm.
And really, flying is dangerous, and a lot of casualties are from aircraft accidents as well as, you know, the combat operations.
And especially in mountains like these, and mountains we're told that are at this point have plenty of Taliban in them.
Sure. That eastern part of the country is still a contested region. And there's going to be a lot of clashes. And as we continue to burrow into those mountain passes, we're going to find more and more insurgents hold up.
There's been a lot of speculation about what a commando unit of four men was doing in this area. It didn't come in, or at least hadn't come in on the 28th by helicopter. We're told speculation in the press that this was some kind of sniper team sent in to hunt down a particular target. Does that sound like the kind of job they would have been tasked with?
Well, there's a number of different types of missions that a small special operations force can do. And usually when you put in a force like that into those areas, they're going to do a number of different types of missions, from reporting, reconnaissance, any kind of interdiction, calling in any kind of air support. So there's a large range of missions or tasks that a team can have.
And what's your sense, Larry Goodson and Anthony Cordesman were talking earlier about the balance between the kind of broader military effort to help bring stability to Iraq, to Afghanistan, and the special operations tasks or role here? Do we have the right balance? Are we depending too much on one or the other?
No, I think we do have the right balance, but both of them are very slow in their progress, and they're going to have setbacks too. But you need to nation build, and you need to build up some type of government that can manage the country. But at the same time, you need to continue offensive operations to try to uproot and destroy the infrastructure that the Taliban laid over the many years they were in power.
And it sounds like we're still very much in the process of attempting to do that. I want to begin to bring our callers in. Solomon's calling from Mooresville, North Carolina. Hi, Solomon, you're on the air.
Good evening. It's nice talking to you guys. I'm a native. I'm originally from Afghanistan.
Yes.
I was born there, and I lived there for the first 12 years of my life, and I still have a lot of relatives who are back there, and a lot of my relatives are going back and forth since the liberation of Afghanistan from Taliban in late 2001.
So what do you hear? What do you think of these recent events, Solomon?
These are horrible. I'm a U.S. citizen, and I have a lot of friends in American military. I feel bad. But overall, and things in Afghanistan have not been this good since 1979 or 77.
That's a long time.
Yeah, so things are much better in Afghanistan, and we just have to be careful not to put Afghanistan and Iraq in the same. They're two different things, first of all. And second, overall, if you take a survey of Afghan people, there are over 90, I would bet 90 or 95% of Afghans are supportive of the American effort there. And things are getting better, even though we've had some setbacks.
Solomon, we appreciate your calling in. Anthony Cordesman, there's the issue that's been raised by reporters in the field there, and not only reporters, some military sources as well, saying that there may be some leakage of Iraq-style insurgent tactics into Afghanistan. Solomon says, let's not conflate these two, and he's right about that. But is there a risk of bleed between the two conflicts, of kind of know-how and tactics being passed back and forth?
Well, there certainly is a series of Internet exchanges, and when you look at them, they're obviously learning from each other. I think sometimes Americans only really pay attention to the conflicts with Americans, because if you look at these websites, you see they're learning from Chechnya, and people are taking historical records from a number of conflicts. Some of them are taken basically as lessons which were learned in the fighting against the Russians. But certainly these people are adapting, and one of the things that we really do have to look out for is that we might see not simply acts of terrorism adapted from Iraq, but attacks as they move toward a legislative election. That's been a major problem in terms of organization. For the first time, it means that the Afghans really have to develop political identities in a very fragmented country.
This is the parliamentary elections of September, 11th, I think, or 18th.
That's right, and one thing that people have learned in Afghanistan is to attack across ethnic and religious fault lines to try to paralyze efforts at unity and nation building.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be surprising if the Taliban and the remnants of Al-Qaeda did not attempt that. What's not clear is how much popular support they'd have in doing it, how easy it would be for them to operate, because outside some of the Pashtun areas, it's very unclear that they could actually operate without finding an immediate resistance from the Afghan population.
Larry Goodson, if I may turn to you, we heard earlier from Halim Karzim about the risk of civilian casualties in the midst of all this. Of course, there was the claim there in Kunar province in the midst of this Operation Red Wing period that 25 civilians died when a U.S. aircraft bombed a compound there that had been cited as a militant holdout. But Hamid Karzai, Afghanistan's president, warned Washington about civilian casualties, eroding public support there. Anthony Cordesman says, here's the critical issue. So far, he sees the population leaning toward the U.S. and Kabul effort. Do you see it the same way?
Yes, absolutely. The population has been generally much more supportive, especially when one does compare to the situation in Iraq, where you also have in places a very supportive population, but you have in places a population that is either intimidated or otherwise willing to support the insurgents. In Afghanistan, generally quite a lot of support, but for the American operations and for the Afghan government operations. But as Tony Cordesman mentioned earlier, one thing that has been a very big issue has been this question of going after the drug trafficking and
mm-hmm.
especially going after the farmer
mm-hmm.
In the field versus the middleman or the big man. which people understand that the government is thus far still sort of protecting at least some of those people involved in the drug trafficking, because they are high-ranking individuals in the government or relatives of high-ranking individuals in the government.
But if you go out after the farmer, that's a threat to life and limb and an economic threat, I guess, at that level. Let's get another call here. Gary is calling from Washburn, Wisconsin. Hi, Gary, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to ask your guest how much he thought the training that the Navy SEALs go through contributed to the loss. As a Vietnam-era Navy SEAL, I know that we were trained never to leave a comrade behind.
Mm-hmm.
And we were proud of the reputation we had for never doing that in Vietnam.
Yep.
And I know that it's still part of the training. I think it's still part of the modern training for SEALs. And I'm just wondering, you know, how much maybe we need to think about this in the light of I know that it creates an esprit de corps to know that your guys are coming back for you no matter what. But you have to wonder when you lose that many guys.
16 is a big number. Let me put that to Major James Gavrilis. Major Gavrilis, we are told, maybe you can confirm, that SEALs are trained to go long periods operating clandestinely. They only call out for help or backup in real extreme circumstances. They did it in this case. 16 were sent out in a big helicopter, and it came down. Our caller says, what about that tradition of never leaving folks in trouble behind?
Well, I think that's the point, that we were certainly not leaving them behind, and that large force that was coming in there is an example of that.
Clearly.
But these are high-risk and high-gain missions, and so, you know, you are putting a few individuals deep behind enemy lines for extended periods of time, and there is a lot of risk, and the SEALs are certainly trained conduct those kinds of missions, and those missions are conducted routinely. What's an exception is this kind of unfortunate accident. But the enemy certainly has a vote, and you know that contact and that that fight was a fight for survival at that point. I think it's very, it's very fortunate that one of the SEALs did survive.
Yeah,
and every single one of those individuals is completely valuable.
Larry, I think I hear you there.
No, it's me. John.
Anthony Cordesman, yes, please.
One point we have to be careful about is this was a tragic incident involving SEALs, but a little over 2 months ago you had another helicopter crash without a direct attack, and 18 Americans were killed in that.
Yeah.
This is a very difficult environment to operate in, and I think tying this one operation where we had a four-man team and you had the loss of 16 others in one helicopter accident to some kind of general rules about operation or whether SEALs should try to rescue their own is a very dangerous thing to do. This is not atypical of what can happen in operations in that country.
And we don't hear this tradition changing. I mean, we're focused on it tonight just because, as Halima Karzan was saying earlier, this is a rare glimpse for those not in the chain of command in Afghanistan into the kind of fighting going on there. We don't get a chance often to see what's going on here. Tragically, in tragic circumstances, we have. Ed is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Good evening. Let me say a quick thank you very much to the fighting men and women that are over there. They've done an incredible job.
Amen.
My son just returned less than 3 weeks ago from that same exact region that chopper went down.
In Kunar province.
Yes.
Tough area.
And he is he has told me that the fighting is bitter. It's been bitter for the last 2 or 3 months. And that in his humble opinion, and he doesn't, military man, he does not question his superiors, but he has told me in his humble opinion that until they quit flowing across the border from the points of our allies, it just can't end.
You're talking about Pakistan there.
Yes, there's just too much coming across that border, and we can pour troops in there forever, but if they're being harbored on the other side of the border, it's just nearly an impossible situation.
Ed, that's an important insight. Thank you for calling in with it. Anthony Cordesman, this goes to your first point, that you've really got a region-wide conflict here. How does the United States begin to address that when its troops are really focused on Afghanistan proper?
Well, I think one has to be careful. We've been addressing this really since 9/11. we put constant pressure on Pakistan. Pakistan has attempted to operate in this region. It is found in the process, as Pakistani governments found before, that when you send regular troops into tribal areas, you often find it almost impossible to accomplish something. The other difficulty we have is this is only part of the problem, because if we could solve the Pakistani problem, then we'd have the Central Asian problem. We're not going to be able to deal with this quickly or easily. We can't simply allow them to operate. You've got to do what you can. But just as you have to win in Afghanistan through politics and nation building, ultimately you're going to have to win in Pakistan on a political and religious level, not simply through troops. And is that going to happen in a few weeks or months? No, we're talking about years at a minimum.
But Larry Goodson, we're hearing from a father of a soldier just back from that front that he sees no end to this until that is addressed, until the Pakistan problem is addressed. Yet that seems like such a long-term problem.
Well, he's absolutely right. I've also been to Assadabad, and I've been in that very area last year, and it's quite rugged, and it's very close to the Pakistani border, and you have a lot of cross-border infiltration. And the Pakistani government has done quite a bit more in the last year and a half or so to be supportive of American goals for Afghanistan, including sending lightly armed forces into the tribal areas and so on. But as Tony points out, that's not the real solution. That's only like sending SEAL teams after specific Taliban leaders. That's only a piece of the solution.
Major James Gavrilis, we've just got a half a minute left here. What's your sense of how special forces in Afghanistan will respond to these events? Will there be a change in the way things are done, or just back to the work?
No, I don't think there's going to be a large change at all. These kinds of missions are routine, and they're conducted successfully without any, you know, fanfare or reporting.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
mm-hmm.
What's exceptional or unfortunate is one incident like this. So
back to the work you expect,
right.
And it sounds from everything we're hearing tonight that there is a lot of work to be done there. Major James Gavrilis, Major U.S. Army Special Forces, recently returned from directing all U.S. Army Special Forces in Iraq. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Larry Goodson, at the Middle East, Director of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College, author of Afghanistan's Endless War. Thank you for joining us tonight, Larry.
You're very well.
And Anthony Cordesman, always good speaking with you. Thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Tom.
Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow and Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Marika Bukas, Persephone Mill, Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.